And sometimes it's the pieces that we think are our most brilliant oeuvres, right? That never take off. It's like the thing, but like, you like this, but wait a minute, look at that one. And, you know, nobody pays attention to the great work that you think you've done, and they're all going for the other thing. You know, it's very funny.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Everything Band, a podcast that features conversations with composers, conductors, and performers of music for winds and percussion. My name is Mark Connor. I'm a composer, and this is episode 53. My guest for this episode is Alex Shapiro. Before we begin, I'd like to thank all of you for listening. I appreciate your time, and I hope that you are finding value from these interviews. I rely on word of mouth and social media to bring the show to new listeners. If you think you know one or two people who might find these interviews useful, please let them know about it. You can also help by following me and sharing posts on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Now on to the episode. Hi, Alex.
Hey, Mark.
So I'm glad you could join me tonight. We have some technical hurdles that we've overcome. We're here. So can you introduce yourself and tell the listeners what you're doing now and where do you live, that sort of thing?
Sure. Well, the reason for the technical difficulties is because I live in the middle of nowhere. I'm sort of the poster child for a composer having a career anywhere in the world, no matter how remote. I think this counts. I live on San Juan Island, off the Washington state, off the coast of Washington state, right on the Canadian border. And it's a wonderful, beautiful archipelago of hundreds of islands. And the population on this particular one is the largest of all of them, which is a whopping 6,500. And no traffic lights, nothing. Our town is about three or four blocks long. And it's just fantastic living here. But of course, with that comes some of the technical issues when it snows, which it rarely does, and then you lose power, which we don't that often. And then you have to get back up to speed. And ironically, Mark and I, just for the listeners, we're doing this at my whopping 1.5 megabits per second speed, which is about to be blissfully changed next week when I finally enter the 21st century and get fiber optic, which we just got wired over to the house, trenched over. But it's fun, you know, all the technical stuff. It's hilarious to me because I'm a composer who works not only in acoustic music, but a great deal of electroacoustic music. And I've got a pretty state-of-the-art digital project studio here in my home. And I always think it's hilarious to be sitting here with this amazing gear and these four 27-inch monitors that look like I'm, you know, flying a 747 or something. But behind me is a wood stove. You know, it's like a Rembrandt painting. And, you know, the most primitive things, 1.5 megabits. Rembrandt didn't have internet, of course, so I'm one up on him. But we've got, you know, incredibly slow internet and heated by wood stove. And, you know, it's just so charming. And yet I'm running all this gear. It always cracks me up. So anyway, so yeah, what I do basically is align notes. As I say in one of my bios, I say I align black dots with the hope that some of them at least will sound good next to each other. I think that kind of sums it up, right, Mark? You're a composer, you know, this is it, right? You're just trying to align the dots.
To the best of my ability.
It's all we can do. It's all we can do.
Yeah. So, Alex, you have a really fascinating story, I think, and before you moved into the acoustic world exclusively, or I don't know, not exclusively, that's not the right word, but before you moved to an acoustic composer, you wrote pop music and film music in L.A.
Right.
And so you had a kind of a career shift, and now you're living in Washington, as you said, on an island off the coast. And writing acoustic music.
Acoustic and electro, or concert music, I guess you'd call it, right?
Yeah, you know? Concert music's a better way to say that. Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Although there's never any good word, by the way. There's no good description for what we do. Concert music sounds, I don't know. Art music sounds, I don't know. I never know nobody has a good moniker for what we do.
No, I use concert, I teach music appreciation. Yeah. I use concert music.
Yeah.
That's the term. For new music, I don't use the term new music very much. I use recent music.
Oh, I like that. I like that.
Because new music, of course, has connotations of, you know, 1960s kind of, you know, experimental concerts.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. Plus, then it doesn't pigeonhole it into any sort of genre.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Recent music. That's recent excellent. Music. I'm going to start using that. Stealing. Love it.
Trademark.
Trademark it.
So let's go back even further, though, because this is a podcast about for band teachers and band directors and the people in the band community. Mm-hmm. But I want to know how you got your start in music and who were the early influences and teachers that sort of got you on the path to a profession.
Well, I think the earliest thing was the great, great fortune of growing up as an only child in the home of two parents who really, really loved classical music. They never played pop music or almost never jazz or musical theater or anything like that, unfortunately. But boy, did they know and love classical music. And because I was lucky enough also to grow up in Manhattan, not Kansas, but New York City. Although I do know a wonderful composer in Manhattan, from Manhattan, Kansas. But at any rate, because I was growing up in New York City, I, as a kid, had every kind of music and all kinds of quality performances at my feet and at my fingertips. And when I was little, you know, my parents would take me to things. And when I was just a little bit bigger than little, starting probably when I was 12 or 13 and could save up my babysitting money to take myself to a standing room opera, standing room spot at the Metropolitan Opera for $3 at the time. This was the mid-70s, folks. Ah, what a time. So, you know, I would be able to have the run of the city. I would go not just to the opera, but I'd be hanging out at the Village Vanguard because at the time nobody, you know, checked for ID. So I could go in as a 14 or 15-year-old to listen to Elvin Jones or the Brecker Brothers or Bill Evans or whoever. I mean, it was just incredible, right? And sit down and just, you know, be cool, order a beer, be able to stay for two sets, all on my babysitting money. And my parents were, yeah, because I was making what, babysitting back then was making me a whopping $1.25 an hour. And I saved it all up, and I would go out once or twice a week. You know, it was sort of my my best education, in a sense, was the city. And my parents were great in that they had a very interesting way of raising me. I guess they figured that I was pretty responsible, and they had the attitude that you raise a kid to feel that they are responsible and let them think the most of themselves, and let them, if they're going to fail, let them fail of their own accord. And so instead of saying, no, you can't go out on a Wednesday night at 9 o'clock to the jazz club or something, they would simply say, okay, you want to go out? Fine. When will you be back? And I would say, well, I think I want to stay for the second set, and the subway takes this much time, you know, coming from downtown to uptown. I'll be back by 1 o'clock. And I think to most parents of a 14 or 15-year-old, that might be alarming. But my parents were very hip, and they said, you know, okay, fine, be home at 1 o'clock. And I always was, always. And I think when you raise a kid to be responsible and you instill in them a sense that you believe in them and that you believe that they'll be responsible, they'll, most of the time, if they're a decent kid, they'll live up to it. So that was my life growing up. And I kind of thought everybody grew up this way. Carnegie Hall, Alvin Ailey, the Joffrey, the Met, you know, the musical theater. I went to all of these amazing shows. I mean, I was steeped in openings. I went to the opening of Jesus Christ Superstar, the original cast of Chorus Line, of Sweeney Todd, of Dreamgirls. I mean, I think back to these days in the 70s of what was going on in New York City. It was amazing, you know? And so I availed myself of all of it. And at the same time, I had started writing really bad music when I was 9 years old. And I had asked my parents for piano lessons when I was 10. And they said, are you going to practice? And I said, yes, 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 I am. And they said, okay. So I started, after starting to compose, I started, you know, learning how to actually play, and always knowing that I was much more interested in composing than performing for anybody. And I stuck with all of that. And when I was 15, I started being in New York City. I had all the great conservatories there. And so I did a summer session at Manus College of Music. And then from there, I did a couple of summers at Aspen, at the Aspen Music School and Festival when I was just 16 and 17. And then I went into Juilliard Pre-College, all as a comp major. And then from there, I went to Manhattan School of Music as a composition major. And so I had this wonderful confluence of growing up in a great city for the arts and growing up with parents who allowed me to avail myself of it, and also with parents who valued education. And when I said I was, you know, this wonderfully adorable, geeky kid who just wanted lessons and wanted to learn, and anytime I would ask them for lessons, they were willing to support that. And I got scholarships for some things, too. But they were really supportive for my education, and that's such a incredible gift. And it's not something that every kid has, as we well know. And all I can say for anybody who's a parent is anything you can do to help support your kids' interests is a great thing. And that's great parenting because, you know, it can turn out to be life-changing for everybody involved. And so I really credit that. So getting from there, from Manhattan School of Music, while I was in school, and my teachers were Ursula Mamlock and John Corigliano. This is before John went over to Juilliard a few years later. And, cause that's just how old I am. We're talking ancient history now. And then I started scoring, low budget, little direct, you know, cable TV things in New York and, you know, finding ways to start working. And I ended up meeting a producer in Los Angeles who needed a direct to video piece of junk scored, but it was a great opportunity to move out to Los Angeles. I had John and Ursula's blessing to do this. I left school after my junior year, and I moved out to LA. And for the next 15 years, I ended up writing in commercial music, which was everything from low-budget film and TV to corporate videos. Price Waterhouse, you know, the envelope, please. Price Waterhouse was one of my big corporate clients. And I did, back in the day before internet, we had these things called CD-ROMs in the, early 90s or late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, I remember.
And so I would do those kinds of projects. I mean, it was hilarious when you think back to the early technology. But, and I worked as an engineer. I worked as a recording producer. I did all kinds of stuff in the business. And then it was a confluence of things again that happened all at the same time that led me to decide to change my career over from commercial music to concert music. And I can't remember quite in what order they happened, because it all happened within the same number of months, but I had just finished scoring a lovely low budget feature film that was all chamber orchestra. I didn't have to use any synthesizers, which most of you listening know that almost everything you listen to in media is with synths. And sometimes the synths are sweetened, you know, the tracks are sweetened with live players, but it's very rare for low budget projects to have all live players, and much less union. And I fought for that. I insisted it be a union picture. So I was really happy on that project, and it really reconnected me with my love of chamber music. And it kind of reminded me why I became a composer all those years ago, you know, to begin with. And at the same time, I had three other low-budget pictures lined up. And composers come in at post-production. You come in after the picture's done. And I swear, every single one, all three of them, right as I was about to start working, each one of them lost their budget. They lost their funding. They ran out of money. Boom. They were done. They shut down production. And I went for months without working. And this was, it was scary, right? This was not cool. And so I remember very well this. You ask, you know, how did the transition happen? Well, one literally rainy day in Malibu where I was living, and there aren't that many rainy days in Malibu, which is why they have so many darn wildfires. And one rainy day when I had absolutely nothing to do when I woke up, which was a very weird feeling, I rummaged around. Somehow I was rummaging around my old files of pieces I had written when I was 19 and 20 at Manhattan School of Music. And I decided to start plucking them out and putting them up on the piano desk and starting to, you know, pound through some of them. And my initial reaction was, oh my God, this stuff is dreadful. You know, it was like, wow, this is crap. But in amongst the crap, there were some germs of good ideas that were just never properly developed, right? And so I decided, with nothing better to do, well, I think I'm going to start, you know, working out some of these ideas, and let me see where this leads. And next thing you know, with all that free time on my hand, I started writing my first concert pieces after about 15 years of not having written anything like that. And it was so wonderful. Not necessarily the music, but my joy in doing it was so wonderful. And I was very lucky that I didn't know anybody in the concert music world, not anybody. And nobody knew me, but I knew some great session players who also loved to play chamber music, and they were interested in pieces, and they ended up performing them locally in Los Angeles and getting them recorded. And next thing you knew, I suddenly had a career going, and I decided very solidly, I decided, you know what, I don't want to pursue film and TV anymore. I really want to do concert music. That's where my heart is. And I followed my passion. I told my agent, I'm not pursuing, you know, commercial music anymore. And I just spent my time writing a lot of concert pieces. And that's how it all began. That's how it all started.
Yeah, that's remarkable.
And I stuck with it. I mean, I think the key thing, and I talk, you know, I do a lot of Skype rehearsals and classes as a guest over Skype, not just as a guest lecturer when I do residencies like at Shenandoah University, where I was just last month, But I love doing all kinds of things via Skype. And one of the things that I talk at length about sometimes with the students is the need not only to follow, to identify your passion and then follow it, follow your gut instincts, but also the need to follow through. And that no matter how talented you may be, sitting in your studio or sitting in your house or just, you know, just hanging in one place, the world is not going to come to you necessarily. So it does take the initiative to get out there and meet people and get involved in the community around you. And you also have to be very prepared. And so preparedness meets initiative, meets serendipity. And the serendipity is all the wonderful chance-like happenings and meetings that happen to us all, you know, when we meet up with the right people who really dig what we're doing or are interested or supportive or whatever. And we follow through because we can, because we're prepared. And it all happened because we took the initiative to get out there, right? And that means, you know, whether you're showing up at a concert and hanging with the musicians afterwards, or whether you're volunteering your time at an arts advocacy organization, of which I've done a lot, and however you're showing up, it all comes back full circle in the most wonderful of ways. And you meet the most wonderful people. I mean, some of my very closest friends have all come into my life because of volunteerism and other things. You know, we were working with the same organizations or showing up at the same things, you know, totally chance and such great people. So, and that's one of the things I love about our world is there are so many wonderful people in it. And I really find that in the band world, I got to say.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's true. The music world is very small, first of all. And the band world is its own little subset of that, which is even smaller. But the band world is very friendly by and large. I mean, I realize that there's all kinds of personalities, but I feel very welcome in it.
Absolutely. It's very welcoming. And very welcoming to new music, most importantly.
It is. Well, recent it is music. Welcoming to new music, both new music and recent music. Yeah. You know, I think it has a tolerance for certain things. But I do want to talk to you about that when we talk about some style things when we talk about writing for young kids, which is what I want to ask you. So you made the transition to concert music from L.A. and New York. And what was it like for writing for kids?
Oh, you mean after I started with band music? Because I had never written for kids before, ever. And it was great. It was, I think the thing that was hilarious to me, because not only had I not written for kids, but I don't happen to have any underfoot here at the house. I'm not a mother. And so I have two cats. And as I often say, that's about all I can be trusted with, I think. And so I wasn't used to the vibe of what it is to be in a classroom with a whole bunch of 13-year-olds. And my respect for band directors is up through the roof, especially for middle school band directors, because that takes a level of patience and just tolerance that is, it's just marvelous. So I think I just got up to speed quickly with not only writing for, with their more limited ranges and abilities in mind and what's going to sound good, for them, but also just the whole concept of thinking for the first time, what are kids interested in? You know, that's a question I hadn't really not had to ask myself in any serious way, until I got a commission from BandQuest, the American Composers Forum series that's so marvelous, BandQuest, where the whole series is to bring composers in. For the longest time, it was composers who had little or no experience writing for band, and that included me. This would have been the piece I did for them is called Paper Cut, and it was my second band piece ever. And the idea is to bring in music that would be a little bit more outside the box, ideally, for middle schoolers. So it was such a challenge for me on a lot of different levels. To back up just a bit, my first band piece came completely out of the blue when I was in my already mid to late 40s. I got contacted in 2008, so 10 years ago. I got contacted out of the blue on the then huge social media site. Try not to laugh too hard, but it was the Facebook of its time, MySpace. Because the great thing about MySpace, as opposed to Facebook, I mean, I love Facebook. I'm very active on it. But MySpace was really set up for musicians because you had a player front and center. It was like being going onto someone's Facebook page and boom, you could hear a whole bunch of their tracks if you wanted to, instead of in that header where there's a big picture, there would be all these tracks. You know, that was MySpace. It was great. So you could really listen to what people were up to. And people collected these friends, and they had their top friends. It was very funny. You know, people would choose their top people. It was kind of like, you know, all the pain and suffering we went through as teenagers in high school, wondering if we would be chosen or not. You know, I was the kid always selected last on all the sports teams. Like, I was the one they were stuck with because I was terrible at sports. And so MySpace and the top friends thing was a little bit reminiscent of that. Like, oh my gosh, where do I rate? But anyway, so not holding out any high hope, but I did have a good time on MySpace. And one person who I later found out, I had no idea who she was at the time, but I later learned, wow, she's actually a really big name in the band world. Anne McGinty, who friended me. We had never met or spoken or anything, but she had friended me on MySpace and decided, I guess she liked what she heard and read. And she put me up one week as her top friend, you know, one of her top friends, which was cool. And I had no idea who she was. Anyway, she had just done a piece the year before, I think, for the U.S. Army TRADOC band, where Commander and Major, then Major, Todd Addison was the head. And he's now at West Point. But at the time, 10 years ago, he was with TRADOC. He was clicking around MySpace and landed on his friend Anne's page and then decided to click on me and listened, I guess, and then sent me a request to commission me via the MySpace message, and which was a very unusual way, I guess, I thought, for someone from the Army to connect. I'm thinking, wow, you know, the Army is trolling for artists on MySpace. How cool is that? But the funniest thing for me was I actually, because I had zero experience in band or military or anything, I literally thought it might be a joke from a friend. I didn't take it seriously at first. And I read, because there was a picture of Todd, who's now my friend, standing in the middle of a field in full regalia. And I swear there was a feather in his cap and a sword and the whole thing, you know, and draped with ropes and God knows what medals. It was very official and looking. And I thought, no way, this couldn't be. So anyway, it turned out, I read it several times to realize, oh my gosh, this really is for real. And it was the nicest request, wondering if I would write a piece for them. Well, I was at once thrilled and terrified, right? Because I wrote back very, very honestly. And I said, thank you so much. You know, I'm really flattered by this invitation. I have to tell you, not only have I never written for band, but I have never even been to a band concert. Because my school, when I was growing up in New York City, we didn't have a band. A lot of those schools didn't have bands in there, in the city. And I was one of them. And I was a pianist and a choral person and a composer person. So what did I know from a euphonium? Nothing. And anyway, I wrote him back. I said, so I was very honest with him. I said, I would be honored to do this, but you have to know I have not had this experience at all. And you know, I neglected to say I'm going to fall flat on my face and end up in Guantanamo. That was pretty much what I was thinking, you know, in an orange jumpsuit. But he wrote back the best thing. He said, well, that's fine, and I appreciate you saying that, but that's actually why we want you. That's why I want you, is because I know you're going to do something different. And I thought, well, my first thought was, wow, finally somebody wants me for my incompetence. Awesome. Yes, success. But then I thought, wow, what a great thing to say to a composer, to say, I want you because of what you don't know, you know, and to give them the chance to discover a new sound world. It was a very seminal moment for me. It was really important. And for those of you listening who happen to be band directors, I can't tell you how wonderful that moment is when you say that to a composer, when you reach out to somebody who might not have a track record and say, I want to give you a shot because I sense that you might have something interesting in you. You know, that's a great thing to say, to take a risk on somebody. And then conversely, for the composers who might be listening to the podcast, I would say to you guys and gals, when I say guys, I'm from New York, so that means that's inclusive of women, just so you know. Some people from the Midwest don't realize that. So when you guys, are looking at potential work situations that are somewhat terrifying, as I was with this, take the risk. Take the risk, because what's the worst thing that can happen, right? I mean, it's only music. You know, it's not brain surgery. You're not going to kill anybody most of the time, unless you just don't give them room to breathe in those long phrases. Then they pass out. But take the risk, and because you never know what it's going to lead to and what wonderful things could happen. And I think my career has been a case in point, because it never in a million years would have occurred to me to write for band up until that moment, ever. It just was not on my radar. And I did it once. I did a piece called Homecoming, which is purely acoustic. It's my only acoustic band piece. And I had a great time doing it, and it gets performed to this day. Fortunately, I did not fall on my face and end up in jail. It was a really positive experience, and I loved it, and it opened up a huge new sound world for me. And I got to tell you, it was just like fireworks went off in my little brain when it came to another way to express myself artistically. So that's the background for, you know, how I got into band music 10 years ago now. And then Paper Cut was the second piece. And again, it was Todd who said to me after I delivered Homecoming and he had premiered it, and he said, "So are you going to go to the Midwest Clinic?" And I said, "What's the Midwest Clinic?" I had never heard of it. I thought it was a hospital somewhere. What's wrong with me? Why do I need to go? What, do I smell bad? Is there a problem? Anyway, he explained what it was. And he said, "You need to go." And I said, "But I only have one band piece. You know, what would I do there?" He said, "No, you need to go." And I took his advice. And that was another smart thing to do. I went in 2008, I guess it was, to my first Midwest Clinic. And I've been going ever since. I think I've only missed one in all these years. It's, as you well know, it is just such an incredible gathering of joy, of musical joy. And it was at that Midwest. The only people I knew there were Todd and the nice folks at the American Composers Forum BandQuest booth, because I had volunteered my time for many years with ACF, and I was the president of the chapter in Los Angeles, and these were people that I had known for a long time, and I was happy to see them there. Anyway, Tom Duffy and Jerry Lucart and John Nichterlein and a whole bunch of people, you know, they were looking at their next year's BandQuest composer, and they gave me a chance. They said, "Would you like to do this?" I said, "Absolutely." And then I was off and running, and I asked them as I started to get into the piece, I said, "Can I do an electroacoustic piece?" They said, "Wow, no one's ever done that before for middle school." I said, "Well, let me try." Because I had done a lot of electroacoustic works in chamber music, and it was something that I just thought would be really fun to bring all these worlds together. And then I think they must have thought I was really nuts when I called them up a few weeks later and I said, "Oh, and by the way, can I add paper? Can I have everybody play paper in this as a percussion instrument?" And I was ready for them to say, "No, forget it." But instead they said, "Sure." And I said, "You know, I realize this piece is probably going to sell like 3 copies. You know, it's just going to tank. It's so weird. Electroacoustic and people play paper." And they were, again, wonderful, and it's yet another great positive life lesson. Instead of saying, "No, Alex, keep it inside the lines," they said, "Do whatever you want to do. We support it." And that's a great thing for an artist to hear, right? And so I went off and running, you know, and I came up with this wacky piece, and it's performed a lot. I had no idea at the time what I was starting. And then subsequently, all my other band pieces are electroacoustic, because that's where I feel I have a unique voice. No matter whether it's a younger piece or an older piece, it's a sound world that I feel that I can be distinct in. Because, you know, at first when I entered the band world, I felt that I was really intimidated, you know, by all the great band composers, the living band composers, and their amazing orchestration and just, you know, the power of those pieces. And I thought at first, "Wow, I can't sound like that." And then I came to my senses and I realized, I don't have to sound like that. They've got that covered, you know, they're doing their thing. I'm going to do my thing, you know, and I had to think about what is my thing. And I had a sense.
All right, Alex, I have lots of questions. I have a couple things. I want to come back to the idea of found sounds and electroacoustic music in the band world. And I also will probably circle back around to the Midwest Clinic. But what's really on my mind is what you just said, because in recent episodes, I've been having conversations with composers about the idea of sort of writing music that's self-published and published. And that's one of my major things that I talk about on the podcast. Yeah. And Tyler S. Grant, the young man, young composer. Do you know Tyler?
Oh, yes. I adore Tyler. I met him many Midwests ago when he was still in diapers, probably. I mean, he is a wunderkind, isn't he? He's amazing.
He is. And he's way smarter than me.
I think he's smarter than all of us. And taller, too.
But Tyler mentioned that he's taken up the practice of self-publishing his band music that's grade 3+.
Mm-hmm.
And commercially publishing his music under grade 2. He feels like that's the best way to kind of reach the greatest audience, mm-hmm. at least for him. But when I talk to people about that, one of the things they bring up is the idea is that you can create a kind of a dual personality and people don't know what to look for from you. How do you feel about that? And I know you're a self-publishing mm-hmm. Advocate.
Right. Well, I'm an advocate for people, for composers getting their music out in the way that best suits them. And for some of them, that will be going with an established publisher. And for others like me, it's going, you know, being self-published with your own publishing company. But I want to add, and this is a very important clarification, that one of my great partners in crime is Hal Leonard Corporation, because they distribute virtually all of my band works, all but one, I think, right now. And just because it hasn't gotten to them yet. And they distribute. They have been incredibly supportive of me. Bruce Bush, who's the head of sales and retail there, he's been amazing in saying, "I know you do weird stuff, and I want to support it. You know, I know it's a niche, but let's start the niche. You know, the electroacoustic band music, okay?" And I grabbed Steve Bryant, who's such a lovely guy and such a good writer, and had done. And I didn't even know anything about any other EA band pieces. You know, when I started doing mine, but Steve had written, I think, Ecstatic Waters. He had already done. And he's got two or three, I think three now, EA pieces. And I said, come on, you know, just do some distribution, you know, do your distribution with Hal Leonard and let's start a thing there. You know, let's grow the EA band world. And now other people are doing it, as well. Jim Mobley, a wonderful band director, has put together a consortium of me, Benjamin Taylor, and Daniel Montoya Jr., over the course of 3 years, EA band pieces for grade 2 or 2.5. Isn't that cool? So, you know, we're growing it. But anyway, getting back to the publishing thing and the identity thing, I snub my nose in this brave new world at the concept that we have to be readily identified for doing one thing, and that used to be the case back in the days when there were bins, like literally when you'd go to this old-fashioned thing called a record store and you'd go to different genre bins, right, to find certain things. And they had to categorize us because that's how music was sold. And it still is to this day, to a large degree, how it's broadcast in the pop world. But increasingly, over the past, certainly the past 20, 30 years, and definitely the past more recent years, anything goes as composers, as you well know. We can write in any genre or many genres at once within one piece. And if we do it well, if we're doing it authentically and convincingly, and with some level of excellence, hopefully, you know what? It doesn't matter what the style is. It matters that it's you. It's your voice. And that's that. There's nothing more important than that. And I throw categories and genres and sticking with a certain style out the window. And instead, I say, if you write, you meaning any composer, you know, writes what's authentic and true to them and follows their own voice and their own passion about what they want to say, they will find an audience for it. And it's not the other way around. It's not like it has to be put in a certain bin in order to build an audience. Uh-uh. This, because of the tools we have, because of the internet, because of, you know, whether it's the internet, which is the global tool, or big conferences where you can meet anybody at TMEA or Midwest or CBDNA, where I'll be headed next month, all these things. We have so many tools now that we didn't have before, and we certainly didn't have them. We had the conferences, but we didn't have the internet when I was coming up, when I was in school, because I left MSM in 1982. That was a long time ago, right? I didn't get my first desktop computer till 2 or 3 years after that, my first Mac SE30, I think it was. And so the world has changed, and there has never been a better time to be a composer. We've never had so much choice and so much opportunity to create fan bases, if you will, to find the people around the world who will naturally dig what we do. And that doesn't have to be everybody. And I think that's one of the key things for composers to always remember. You don't have to have everybody love your music. It would be crazy to assume that everybody's going to love our music. That's fine. I can hand somebody a disc of my music and know that they're not going to love everything on it. And that's fine. But maybe they'll find one or two things on it that they will love. And it's the same thing with putting our work out into the world, is you make yourself available and you make your work available. And out through that woodwork comes these great opportunities to meet wonderful people who really do want to play your music and commission more of it. So, yeah, that's my long-winded, as all of my answers are, of course, can't shut me up. But that's my attitude about this, is that there is no rule book anymore. And composers should feel free, in my opinion, to write anything in any style and see where it goes. I don't think anybody wonders who I am in terms of, where do we pigeonhole her? I think when they're commissioning me, they know they're going to get something very different every time, because some of my pieces really don't sound like they've been written by the same composer. In that residency that I mentioned last month at Shenandoah University with Tim Robley and Jonathan Newman, and it was so much fun. And they did four of my pieces, and two of them in particular were done, two band pieces were done back to back. And I think I said that to the audience, because it's really true. They couldn't have been more different. One was like really somber and slow and minimalist and just weird and almost atonal. And the other one was like a pop piece almost, you know? And I think it's so much fun that we can do this now. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd like to get John Newman on the show.
Oh, he's so wonderful. I'm sure you can get him.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
His music is, he has a nice pop edge to his mm-hmm. music. Blow It Up, Start Again is one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah.
That piece is, dubstep for
exactly.
band is something.
Exactly. And he's such a nice guy. You'll have a great time talking with him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, just to come back to the electroacoustic, the idea of using found sounds, there's a couple of pieces in the beginning band repertoire that have kids bang on mm-hmm. stands, and there's some sort of aleatoric pieces in the repertoire. Epinesion from the 80s is one I think about. But the idea of found sounds for band, what sort of, where was the inspiration for that?
Well, with Paper Cut.
I'm speaking of Paper Cut
right,
rocks.
Rock music.
Rock music,
and Liquid
right?
Compass uses bowls full of water and sponges dripping the water into the bowls, very resonant, as the players walk through the audience. And I've got that same sound. These are samples that I made that I also include on the track. And so you have this very surround sound, multi-dimensional experience of when that piece is done, where the track is playing kind of these distorted water sounds that I've recorded in my studio. And in live time, six percussionists are walking down the aisles very slowly, dripping water from these huge automated sponges or something, into these big metal cooking bowls, that you can get at a thrift store. And so the audience can't tell really where the water sounds are coming from. And I just love messing with audiences. I get paid to mess with people. That's my motto. But I love doing that. With Paper Cut, that inspiration came out of utter and sheer genuine frustration at 3 a.m. And I have often told this story. I love telling it to the bands when I'm doing a sky rehearsal with them, when they want to know, why did you come up with Paper? How did that happen? I always tell them the story about it was 3 a.m, the deadline was looming, and I was coming up with bad idea after bad idea. And I was on my 16th really bad idea, meaning it wasn't holding my interest. It certainly wasn't going to hold an audience's or a band's, right? It wasn't good enough. And by that time I knew it would be electroacoustic, but I still hadn't found my melodic in material. And I was getting very cranky because it was 3 a.m. I probably looked deranged, kind of like the Unabomber version of a Unicomposer or something, with a jar of peanut butter or possibly a glass of scotch. I don't know which way it went, but however it was, I was probably in my pajamas and my hair up looking crazed. And, and finally I was so frustrated after the 17th bad idea that I crumpled up my paper like a petulant child and I threw it down to the ground at my feet. Forget it. And because it was so quiet, I really heard that sound of the paper. I don't know why. Maybe it was the scotch.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I leaned down and I picked up the paper. And suddenly I found myself playing with the paper in the absolute quietness of the early morning hours and playing with the sounds of the paper. And a light bulb kind of went on, and I thought, wow, if it sounds this good with just me doing it, what would it sound like with 40, 50, 60 more people playing it? And then I was off and running. I took out my iPhone, and I started sampling as many different kinds of paper sounds as I could come up with, tearing it, shredding it, ripping it, doing rhythmic rips, crumpling it, all the things you can do with paper, rubbing it. And I stopped short at setting it on fire. I didn't think that would go well in live performance. But I started, recording all these samples. And I then was able to dump them from my phone onto my computer and clean them up to the point where, I could trigger them with my keyboard. And I don't use any paper samples in the piece, in the track. But I wanted to play with those frequencies so that I could write around them, because you don't want too many frequencies stepping on each other, so that when the live players played the paper live, it would sound kind of cool. And it would also be very visual. And I realized it was my first moment of aha multimedia, because I realized to make the paper sound good, it has to be played over people's heads. Well, wow, that's going to look kind of interesting to the audience. And so then I was thinking about colored paper, and I was thinking about choreographing which sections do what when, knowing that sections tend to sit in, predictable places, right? So I created a small nightmare for myself in terms of the challenge of the complications of all this, but it was really fun. And that's where the paper came up. And then the rock thing came for rock music, which is a grade 2.5 piece that is played by adults as well. It's one of those, all-encompassing kinds of pieces. And for that one, which is a very minimalist piece, I literally live on rock. San Juan Island is all rock. Glaciers carved out these rocks 15,000 years ago as they, scraped across these islands. And I had a wonderful commission from Chris Gleason and the Sun Prairie Middle School band and in Wisconsin. And they also are at a very similar latitude as I am, a little bit south of here, maybe, but not much. And I was thinking about geology, and I was thinking about climate change. And I was thinking about how all of us, myself included, might love nature, but we don't get out enough. We're working so hard and in front of our screens all the time. And wouldn't it be great to give students a reason to have to go outside and look down and consider what they're walking on, consider the earth? And so no matter where you live, you could be in the middle of New York City and you'll always find two rocks. You can find rocks anywhere. When I was a kid, I used to climb every rock in Central Park, all those little pieces of bedrock that are jutting up. Yeah. And so rock music came about from my desire to put rocks in people's hands and get them listening to them and touching them and making sounds from them and considering the connection to the environment and to the substrate under them and the planet. And then to extrapolate from that and to go on to the influences, many of which are sadly very negative, that human behavior is having on our planet. So it's a way of bringing all of these things to people's attention just through a pair of rocks, So that's how that came about. So those are just, a few examples. But I love it. I mean, to me, and the message for any student is that anything around us is potentially an instrument. We can make music, and you know this, you're a wonderful composer. You can make music from anything you're looking at right now in whatever room you're in, and it's so much fun to bring that to light for younger players and to have them realize that.
Yeah, sure. So This, Paper Cut was a huge success, right? It got performed at Midwest and is in teaching music through performance and band and lots.
And we sell many copies a week of the thing all these years later. It's amazing. I would never have guessed it in a million years, which is also an interesting side thought for composers, is that you never know which of your pieces are going to tank and which ones are going to become popular. You just never know. And so treat all of your works that you choose to publish, the ones that leave your studio, treat them all with a lot of respect and worthiness, and make sure that you've got your copyrights in line and if you've got contracts, make sure all the contracts are right, because you never know when something is going to take off.
Yeah.
You just don't know.
Let me play the role of a listener who might be a junior high band director or high school band director, and they're thinking, wow, this is great. I hadn't heard of Alex. I'd really like to do Paper Cut or another electroacoustic work. What kind of equipment do they need to...
Real simple. The absolute bare basic is just a pair of a laptop and a $30 pair of USB headset, and then just a connection out to a basic PA system in any hall, you know, that gets connected out to the mixing board, which is connected to the speakers. A little bit better way of doing it is to have an inexpensive, what's called a digital audio interface, which is a very simple little box that you plug the that you route everything through, and so that connects to the laptop and your headphones, and then it routes the click track and the regular track. Because I should explain what this is. You have there are at least two sets of audio tracks that one is supplied with a electroacoustic piece. One stereo pair is usually stereo. I mean, one could do a surround mix, but that's most places aren't set up for that. One stereo pair is just the track, you know, alone, as it should be heard by the audience, which is going to meld seamlessly, one hopes, with the actual live band on stage. And it all, the sound triangulates in the audience, and it's a wonderful thing when it all comes together. But what the conductor hears in her or his earbuds is a click track along with that track. They hear a click to keep the track and the band together, because otherwise it's like a bad sporting event and you never know who's going to get to the finish line first, right? Because they get out of sync. So so you need, the audio interface is very good for routing the click to the conductor's earbud and then the non-clicked version of the track out to the audience. So that's all you need. And what we do with the first cheapest version that I mentioned, I send the user, if they need it, what's called a multi-channel file. And that is created in a piece of software where it actually automatic, if you play it back through a piece of software called VLC, is the one that I use, which is free, as I recall, you play it back through that and it actually automatically splits the routing of the click, the track with the click and the track without the click. So it does the work for you. Yeah. So it's, I think sonically there, it might not be as great, as going through an audio interface, but in a pinch, it certainly works just fine. And, cause you know, my job is to, if I'm asking people to play unusual music, I want to be as helpful as possible. And I know Steve Bryant and other people feel the same way too, that we provide a lot of resources on our sites. And when we deliver pieces, we include PDFs on the tech setup, and we're totally available, you know, pretty much 24/7 if there's a crisis. And I can't tell you, you know, that over the years, there have certainly been some memorable moments when, you know, they are minutes from the downbeat and something goes awry or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
and they really
want to
play your piece.
Yeah, exactly. And so you can always help. So far, there really haven't been, you know, too many crash and burn moments. You know, with the way I do it, I create all my EA works, electroacoustic works, with a pre-recorded track. So it's really set it and forget it, as we like to say. So there's less chance of crashing and burning and problems. Other people, and I know Steve does it this way, use a wonderful program called Ableton Live. And the events, and you can do this with other sequencers as well, the events are live triggered. So you have a musician playing the laptop. You need an extra pair of hands playing the laptop and triggering the cues and the events to that happen along with the band. It gives some flexibility, certainly, in terms of when those events happen. But it also, you know, it ups the ante a little bit for stress level, just making sure, you know, things don't crash in the middle of a performance. So, but it's a wonderful way to do the music.
All right. So I'm going to get into my my questions here that I ask everybody.
Uh-huh.
And so, well, first, before I do that, in case anyone's listening that wants to commission an Alex Shapiro original, what would they do? How would they get in touch with you, and what would they be thinking?
Well, they'd be thinking, how do I rob a bank? No, just kidding.
What's their process?
The best way to get in touch with me is always email alex@alexshapiro.org, O-R-G. And so my website is alexshapiro.org. And there's a special WinBand page there where you can delve into all these pieces. I think I've written, depending on how you count them, so far it's 9 pieces or 12 pieces, because one of the pieces, called Immersion, is performed as a 3-movement work, and also each of the 3 movements are performed separately on a regular basis too. So that's a fair amount of material at this point I've been collecting. And I've got a premiere. I'm very excited next week, University of Puget Sound is one of the consortium members for a new piece called Trains of Thought, electroacoustic band piece, and Gerard Morris will be conducting the band there at the SCI National Convention. which is happening there during that weekend. And I'm really excited to hear this piece for the first time. You know the feeling when you go from that, what the sonic chaos is in your head, to finally actually hearing the notes in the air. And it's fun. We hope
there's a magical moment there. Always, every piece.
Yeah.
I think that's why I compose. Someone asked me, a young composer asked me today about that. And he asked me, so why I do it. And it's really about that moment when the piece comes together.
Yeah.
And all those puzzle pieces seem to fit together. It's remarkable.
It is.
It's a remarkable feeling.
Absolutely. Such a high. It is a total high. Yep. As are the moments, you know, when you're writing and you're in the zone, you know, that feeling.
Oh, yeah.
And it's you don't get that every day. You're not in the zone every day when you're writing.
Haven't been there in months.
We got to get you back in the zone.
I know. I've been doing other things. A lot of things going on outside.
Yeah,
of the
music it's hard when there's a lot of other stuff because you need time to get in the zone. You need to shut everything else out. But that's another thing. The process of writing is such a wonderful and beautiful thing, especially when it's going well. Every composer knows what it feels like when it's not going well, especially when there's a deadline and it's not going well.
Yeah, I've got that. I'm facing that right now. But that's okay. That's neither here nor there. Sometimes deadlines are strangely liberating for the creativity.
Yeah, because you have to make a decision. That's right.
And you have to let go. You have to let go of your inhibition and just write. It's like Stephen King calls it writing behind the closed door.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, you just write and you write and you write and you don't worry about what it is and you come back at later and you fix it.
Yep.
And sometimes a deadline forces you to do that.
Agreed. Absolutely. And it's interesting working in commercial music for many years. That's where I learned deadline writing because as you know, there's not a lot of time for those cues to pour out. And they give very little time on these projects for the most part. And you learn to just buck up and do it, you know, just put your big girl pants on and get the work done. And you just don't moan and groan about it. Get it done. Stay focused. And that teaches you, wow, I can do it. You know, and I think that it taught me that message of, wow, when I went from commercial to concert music, it gave me that sense of, wow, I know I can deliver on deadline. I have done much tighter deadlines than what I get for a concert piece, you know?
And it's a very different world. I once heard on Garrett Hope's podcast, which you appeared on, a composer who writes for TV.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about how he writes so much music every week. He can't imagine a concert composer who only writes two or three pieces a year.
Right.
And when I remember hearing that episode on that show, on that podcast, and thinking, wow, I need to write more music. It was, in some ways, it was very inspiring for me as a concert composer.
Yeah.
To say, well, you know what? Other people are writing this much and they think this. So, you know, I can do that too.
Right. Now, in fairness, not all of those commercial cues are for full orchestra, full choir, full band, full whatever, or intricate string quartet writing or whatever. I mean, you know, you have to take into account the nature of the piece. But it can certainly be said that not every concert piece is that complicated. And for the ones that aren't that complicated, yes, I think it's a great tool to be able to write fluidly and to write eloquently and well and with some alacrity. I think that's not a bad thing. And especially
You say it right on your website under commissions. Don't worry about deadlines. I write smoothly under them. And I think that's a great turn of phrase for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never missed one yet. Even under duress, I've had some interesting interruptions happen and my clients wouldn't know it. You know, it's sort of, and I think again, that comes from all the commercial work. Anybody who's worked in the commercial world knows that you just deliver, you get it done and it's good. You don't deliver crap. You deliver, I would like to think that I'm delivering the same quality of piece in X amount of time that I would deliver if I had twice as much time. You know, that it's just, you learn to kind of sit down and make your muses show up for work with you. That's always the term I use. And sometimes I bribe my muses with red wine, with chocolate, with single malt. I'll bribe them with whatever they want. If they want chocolate, they get chocolate. But they have to show up for work when I do. That's always my attitude.
So I know that you work a lot with kids. And one of the questions I ask all of my guests is, where do you draw the line between healthy and unhealthy competition in music?
Well, and it's funny because since I'm not a teacher, I'm not exposed to that aspect of it. I'm like the grandparent. I get to come in, play with the kids, have fun with them, and then hand them back to the teacher and say, bye, that was fun. Right. So I am aware of those competitions and honor bands and all that. And I certainly have worked with a lot of honor bands. And I guess I know that they go through something, I'm sure, to be selected to be in the honor band. But I have to tell you, that's not a world to which I can speak with any intelligence, because I don't have any experience in it. But I can say in an overview, and certainly watching how kids are raised and knowing of competitions, I don't think that competition is ultimately a very good thing for the human spirit in the arts. It might be good for other things. There might be a good reason to have competition, getting back to brain surgeons or things like that, because you do want the best. You want someone who's going to be the best at this. I don't think there are any brain surgery competitions out there, but that would be amusing if there were. Although I wouldn't want to be the person they're competing on. because what if you get the person who fails, who comes in third? You don't want to be the patient of the person who comes in fourth on the brain surgery competition.
Well, you know, the old joke is, what do they call the person who finishes 50 out of 50 in medical school?
What?
Doctor.
Yep, there you go. But in general, in the arts, I am not in favor of competition at all. And I can tell you, I have addressed this a lot on the composing side. And it's a point anybody who's ever heard me speak before has heard me say something along these lines, which I'll say now, which is that I firmly believe that the only person with whom we are in competition is ourselves. And that there is the sense of scarcity is a very unhealthy way to go about thinking of life and thinking about one's artwork. That instead, a sense of abundance will serve you much better. Because as I said earlier in the show, there are so many opportunities if you just get out there and look under the rocks and make yourself available. And you just have to keep looking under the rocks and making yourself available. And when those things happen, the pie just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It's not one pie, one size, and it can only be sliced up for those top 20 composers over there, you know? No, no, no. If that were the case, we'd only have 20 top composers, right? And nobody else would be getting performed. But that's not the case at all. And everybody can form their own niche and their own weather storm of a career, you know, with what they do best and with the people who respond to it. And there's room for all of us. And that has been my experience. That certainly, I mean, I often refer to myself as the happy village idiot. Maybe I'm bumbling along, not knowing any better. And all of you guys are shaking your head out there thinking, oh, she's so clueless. Well, if that's the case, I may be clueless, but I'm really happy. And so I want to recommend this happiness to my peers and just say, you know, the competition is often in our own minds. And earlier, I also mentioned how I felt when I first started writing for band 10 years ago, I felt completely intimidated and I guess competitive in a weird way, in a sort of backward way. I felt like I was in competition with all the great band writers out there because, my God, I could never sound like these people. And then I dropped that. I realized, no, you know, they are them. I'm going to be the first me. No one's going to sound like me, just like I'm not going to sound like them. And that's fine. Sound like yourself. And that's what you're bringing into the world as an artist. And that's one area where, for the most part, concert music is very different than commercial music, in that, for the most part, there are obviously exceptions in commercial music, but in general, commercial music serves a certain purpose. And the number one purpose is not so that Alex Shapiro can sound just like her, you know. It's to serve the picture and it's to serve the needs of the director and or the needs of the, you know, the item that's being sold through the jingle or whatever the thing is. Whereas concert music is all about the artist and it's all about the artist's voice. And those are two distinctions. And so if you are an artist doing concert-based music, then there is no competition because the reason you're doing your art is because you sound like yourself. And the reason someone's hiring you is because you don't sound like the next person. Somebody who wants Mark doesn't go to Alex. They're going to go to you, Mark, right? Because you sound like you. And I'm never going to sound like you, you know? So, and that's a great thing. I would never in a million years feel competitive with my peers. And I want to, you know, spread that gospel if I can and just suggest that as a way of considering one's life and art, that it is what you want to make it.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I am fond of using the saying, a rising tide lifts all
boats.
Yes,
absolutely.
I don't know, but you know, I really appreciate your thoughts on this, because I think, I don't know if I heard you on Garrett's podcast. I know
he's wonderful, isn't he? He was really fun to talk to.
He is wonderful. Yeah. And his show's great.
I love his show.
Yep. But this whole notion of competition, I love the way you have this worldview, and you're just believing it so much, and it comes through very clearly. It's why I thanked you in the beginning for being such a strong advocate, because as a composer, you lift me up by saying these things.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. That's what we should do for each other, right? As we talk about this stuff, all of us, and it goes out into the air, and it becomes something like, oh, yeah, of course, right? And I think talking about these things, that people don't talk about them very much out in the open in a positive way, you know? And I'm glad to hear that, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some band director out there listening going, okay, can we talk about band again? But
enough of this woo-woo stuff.
Well, no, but I think these are lessons that apply across a broad spectrum of the arts and in music. Yeah. So, okay, well, to be more specific, let me ask you this question. How do you achieve your work-life balance?
Ah, that's a big one, right? Everybody deals with this. I tell you, the older I get, the more aware of it I am. And this year has been a seminal year for that, for me, because a whole bunch of things have happened all at once, and they're all good. But it really made me face, what are my priorities, and what do I want to do? And I think one of the answers does have to do with age, in that the work-life balance is going to be different when you are in the midst of building your career in your 20s and 30s and into your early 40s maybe. And then suddenly what happens is, if you've done a decent job of, you know, establishing yourself, by the time you are in your 50s and 60s, it does maybe change, because you feel like you have the luxury of time and established catalog and whatever to be able to adjust your priorities a little bit. But those adjustments might just be for a short period of time. You know, it ebbs and floods like the tide. It depends on what the workload is and what the workload is that one has chosen. So I went through a couple of years ago, I took on a lot of pieces in one year, and it was what I call happy stress. I was very stressed, but I was doing work I loved. But I was still very stressed, and I came out of that, and I was doing a lot of other things too, all the advocacy stuff with ASCAP, et cetera, and a lot of travel and a lot of speaking and yada yada, a whole bunch of things. And then my happy life here on the island. And it was kind of, it was a bit too much. I mean, I managed through it all just fine, but I realized, you know, that's a little crazier than I want. And so now I'm managing it by looking at things that come onto my docket or opportunities that come to me in two ways, or I should say maybe in one way with two answers. Somebody suggests something or asks something or something comes up, and a lot of the time it's that would be really nice, or that would be nice, or that's cool. But at this point, it's got to fall much more into the category of hell yeah. It's got to be a hell yeah, I want to do that. And I think that's a luxury that one has when one is older. I don't think I would have ever given you this answer 15 years ago. You know, I think you have to earn it in a sense and get to a certain point in your life where you can weed things out and take the hell yeah stuff. Because work is so important to work and write and develop what you're doing. And that doesn't stop. I don't mean to imply that, you know, I'm done, lights out, we're off, you know, I've written everything I can write. No. And I certainly would never imply that I'm particularly excellent at what I do. You're always trying to get better and better and better until you keel over, right? Until the last breath that you take. And that's a great thing about being a composer, is you can keep writing when you're decrepit. It's wonderful. So...
Who was the cellist? Was it Peter Gorski that said, why do I practice? It's because I can, or because I still have much more to learn.
Yeah,
or
something. There you go.
In his 90s.
Yep.
I can't remember who that was. Someone's out there listening going, it was Pavel Casals or something like that.
Whoever it was, they were right. I mean, you you keep doing it and you love doing it. But I do think that age plays a factor in where you are in your career and how you balance your life things. For me, I have recently moved into what I consider the dream home. I'm in this beautiful place with this incredible life partner, Dan, who is just an amazing force in my life. And to be able to spend, and I live in paradise here on San Juan Island, and to be able to spend a little more time here and doing things that I really love that have nothing and everything to do with music, like kayaking or the nature photography or all the things. or, you know, being on the boat on the water, and hiking around and just being in nature and being with friends and all of that, that's very important. And I want to be around for a lot of that. And but I love doing the other stuff too. So I'm just trying to, you know, pick and choose what are the important things. And with writing, it's interesting because I'm taking on a few less projects each year for the reason that I love composing, the process of composing so much. I want to be able to steep myself in it that much longer. I don't like when I'm in the groove writing one piece, having a great time in the moment of, you know, unfolding one sound world. And in the back of my mind, I realize, well, I better finish this by next week because I've really got to start on the next thing, you know? And so your mind is thinking about both pieces at the same time. One is in the forefront of your consciousness. The other is in the subconscious a little bit, but they're both being worked on. And you have to, sometimes a lot of composers are probably nodding their head that you have to jump off of a piece you're having a good time with, maybe a little sooner than you feel like jumping off because you have a responsibility, you know, to get going with the next piece. And I'm trying to now avoid that. I'm trying to give myself more time between commissions so that I can really delve deep, you know, and have such a great time with each piece because I love the process so much. Do you feel that way in your work, that you love the process a great deal and you want to spend more time with it?
Yeah. Well, I do and I don't. I have a love-hate relationship with composing. I mean, I love it. I love the process. I love when I get into the deep work. But I struggle a little bit with what Stephen Pressfield calls the resistance. That initial opening up of the work is a struggle for me some days. And it's part of because I have a little bit of imposter syndrome that I deal with. And so I always feel a little bit self-conscious, even when I'm by myself writing. So, you know, I have an interesting relationship with it, but I do love it when it's going.
If it makes you feel, if it makes you feel any better, every composer I know, no matter how famous they are, I'm talking about big, big, big composers, they suffer from imposter syndrome. They feel like they're a fraud. They look at the blank page. They have no idea what they're going to do. It is amazing. You are in good company. I mean, it's all... Really, everybody suffers from this. We all suffer from this. I think it's just part and parcel of the gig, of the job description, is that you're going to wake up some days and not put anything on the paper or not put anything of worth, you know, that meets with your approval on the paper. And it's okay. It's okay. You got to give yourself permission for those days. I build those days into my commission timelines. When I back time, how long it's going to take me to do something, I actually build in the I feel like an idiot day, you know, like I can't come up with anything day. I'll build in plenty of those, you know.
Composing's hard. It's a hard thing to do, so.
It is.
But I do love the moments when it's going really well. And it's just me and the music, and I can see it all. It's all like clicking so well.
Yeah. And that's what keeps you back. It's like a drug. It's that intermittent behavioral reinforcement. That's what I would call it. It's the rat in the cage with the cocaine or whatever that they keep hitting the bar. And sometimes the bar gives them, you know, the drug or the sugar or whatever. And a lot of the times the bar doesn't give them anything, but they keep hitting the bar because they want to get the drug or the sugar.
Yeah.
Right?
That's
intermittent behavioral reinforcement. That's, we are all the gerbils in the cage. That's all we are. But we write better music than gerbils, as far as we know. Who knows? Maybe gerbils have banned music that we haven't heard yet because we don't speak gerbil.
If gerbils could play the clarinet, what would they write? So this is a big question. And now you're sort of outside the world a little bit, but you're in it. And so I want to ask you, what do you think are the big challenges facing music education and or band and or music in general as we move forward in the 21st century?
Public support and government support and valuing arts education in the schools. And we've been seeing over many years the deterioration of education funding, right, coming at many different angles, whether it's at local school board level or national, federal level, arts agencies. You know, when you have a president of the United States who wants to get rid of the National Endowment for the Arts, we got a problem, right? And when you have a culture that is increasingly separated somehow or unaware of the arts, we have a problem. And I think about this a lot, even though I don't have kids and I'm not teaching, it still is something that I think about constantly because it's our future. And I think that one of the important things professional composers can do is to be involved in educational music. I think it's vital because we have to pick up the slack, if you will, by getting involved with the schools, getting involved with the students, writing the material that is going to be challenging and good for their souls and their brains and their hearts. We have to take an active role and help. We got to help the teachers. I think that's a job of the composer. And because even most of those kids aren't going to grow up and become, you know, trumpet players professionally, but hopefully most of them will grow up wanting to go to concerts and wanting to support the arts themselves. And when they have kids, you know, wanting to support their kids' interest in the arts, and that's how it spreads, you know. So I think it's really important. I think we're in a very difficult time. We have been for a number of years. It's there's something about the United States of America for these past number of years that is very unpleasant on so many levels. But one of it is that too many people in this country simply don't value what we do. And the need for art and music of any era, it doesn't have to be new music. It could be anything from, you know, 200 years ago, but it's not being valued. And it makes me deeply sad. So we have to fight against that. We have to pick up the slack.
I was trying to tell my students about Leonard Bernstein today and his his lectures at Harvard.
Yeah.
And how that was such a cultural phenomena at the time. And we haven't had that in a long time.
No, we haven't. We need more and more of it. I mean, I think in a sense, one can find things all over YouTube that are inspirational and wonderful, whether it's TED Talks or other, the gazillions of files up there on YouTube, and people can tune in, but you have to know where to look, right? And you have to know, you have to take the initiative, and a student needs a teacher maybe to guide them to say, look up the young people's concerts, right? Or look up, you know, all of these things that are so inspirational. They're not going to necessarily find them on their own. They need some guidance. So I think there are a lot of wonderful people doing a lot of wonderful things in education. But in this country, it seems to be constantly overshadowed by this ignorance on the federal level. You know, a great guest for your program who can speak so eloquently on this and passionately is Chris Gleason. Do you know him? He's
No.
He's a band director in Wisconsin. I mentioned him earlier, and he did a presentation at Midwest this past year that I attended, and he was just on fire. He won one of these big Teacher of the Year awards. If he's listening, he's thinking, come on, Alex, don't you remember the name of it? And I don't. But it's like a really big, important award. He's an amazing educator and a great, great guy and a huge proponent of living music and a great gift to his students. And he speaks so well on this topic. So if you can grab him as a guest, I recommend it.
All right. So what advice would you give the 18-year-old Alex at her high school graduation?
Don't date that guy you're thinking of dating. Bad news. Oh, man.
Maybe beyond that.
Maybe beyond my dating life, yeah. just that I think most people, when we're young, we make a lot of wrong turns, because one of the best things to do when you're young is to try a lot of different things, and not everything's going to work out all the time. And for me, a lot of things did not work out, and I just kept bumping into a lot of walls, you know. But to just, I think, I don't know if it's advice or if it's just a assurance to say to the 18-year-old is, don't worry, keep at it, it will work out. You know, just keep your head above water, and it will all work out. You know, that you have to have faith in yourself to know that you will land on your feet, even because it took me a long time, I think, to feel like I had landed on my feet. I don't think I felt like I had things together until my 30s. I don't know what I was doing in my 20s, but I was doing some interesting things, but I really, looking back, I feel like I was flailing. And so I think of myself as a bit of a late bloomer. But I think that sense of just when anybody is young, having faith in yourself, believing in the work you're pursuing, and that you're on the right track. And also knowing that if you're not on the right track, you can change it. Like I did when I was 37 years old and said, I don't want to do film music anymore. I want to write concert music. You know, that you're hardly a spring chicken at that point to be changing your career path, right? Because even though it's still music, it's a very different part of music, very different people, very different, you know, venues. And so I think it's important for everybody to know that it's okay to make changes and to eat, nothing has to be for 50 years, you know? I mean, I'm not, marriage aside, I mean, it would be nice if marriages last that long, but there's nothing in your life has to be the constant forever. You can make change. And that's a good thing to remember. It's not a bad thing, you know, to give yourself permission to change your mind about something.
I get some great answers for that question.
How do you answer it? If someone were to ask that of you, what would you say to 18-year-old Mark?
I just got asked, I just got interviewed by a college freshman today, and he asked me the same question.
what did you tell him?
My answer is that you have to take success and failure equally. And that you don't look at a failure as a musician or in your life as an indictment of yourself or as a criticism of who you are as a person, but as an opportunity to grow.
Very good.
That's the short answer.
Absolutely. And I would add to that by saying, and I bet you agree, that it's not really failure. It's just continually trying to succeed in different ways. And it's not failure when you keep trying at something until you get it right. It's very rare to get something right on the first bounce or the first try. It's almost, that would be a little lazy and a little too easy, and it rarely happens. And that's why we sit and try 16, 17 starts to a piece before the 18th one is the one, you know? I mean, you know, that's not failure, that's trying. There's a difference.
The few times that I succeeded on my first attempt at things have actually probably been more detrimental in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
I told him, he asked me, so how'd you become a composer? And I said, well, you know, I was a music ed major and I was not progressing on my trumpet how I thought. And I was just kind of casting about trying to find myself. And I took an elective in composition. And the first piece I wrote, everyone loved. Like, I kept getting all this praise. And I thought, wow, that was pretty easy.
Little did you know.
Little did I know that I actually had to work to get better. It took a little while to figure that out.
That's funny.
But yeah. So, if you could plan it out, what would be the final work that you'd conduct or hear or interact with? The final piece of music?
Oh, wow. That's heavy.
A little bit, but it doesn't have to be dark.
What do I want to hear on my deathbed?
I guess, no, it doesn't have to be dark in that way. I guess what it is what's personal to you in that way?
Well,
not your favorite, because
that's different. You know what's really personal to me? For some reason, I don't know why, but when I sit down at the piano, this is one of the things that I just love playing. And I think I play it I've been playing it since I was probably 14, and I continue to play it, and I play it a different way with different emotion many times over. It's a simple piece, and it just kills me. It's the second movement to Bach's Italian Concerto for piano. It is so simple, and it's just, there is an elegant mournfulness to it. And a bit of a rage toward the end of it, for those of you who know the piece, that just, it's a piece I come back to a lot.
All right. And so is there anything coming up? Now, this is going to be late March, Alex. Is there anything coming up that you would like to share or promote?
Well, it's not coming up anytime soon, but it's on my mind because we've really just been putting the final touches on a consortium that has been formed for a flute and percussion and electroacoustic piece for flute and percussion. And it is, I'm going to reach over here and just say it's with Tessa Brinkman and Terry Longshore, the percussionist. Tessa is the flutist. They are incredible players. They're based in Oregon. And we're embarking on a really fun project, and I'm looking forward to that. And that'll be delivered at the end of the year. So that's when I finish doing what I'm up to now. I'm going to be throwing myself into flute and percussion electroacoustic music for a while, which will eventually end up in a band iteration, I'm thinking in the back of my mind that it will be that kind of a piece that will be good for flute and percussion duo, which is how we're starting, and then flute ensemble and percussion ensemble, and then full band. And that's what we're thinking of, is a staged kind of thing. So if anybody listening is interested in getting in on this, it'll be great fun, I guarantee.
I have a conductor friend who calls that use the whole buffalo.
I love it. Yes, you know, that's a great expression. I'm going to tell Tessa and Terry that.
Right.
Use the whole buffalo.
So get as much out of it as you can.
Yep.
And there's nothing wrong with that, especially when you're supporting yourself through your music.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's amazing how many pieces also do very well in various adaptations. And I say this to composers all the time. There is absolutely no shame at all in taking a piece, you know, a chamber piece or whatever, turning it into a band piece, or taking a chamber piece for one set of instrumentation and turning it into something else. That happens all the time. All I would say is, if you're doing it for a commission, make sure your commissioners know that you're doing that and make sure that's fine with them. And that's actually... we get into a little bit of business for a moment here, but it's something I always suggest to composers when if they have somebody who would like to commission them but can't quite afford a full commission fee, and they'd really like a new piece. One of the nicest things you can do is to reach into your catalog and see if there is something that you've written that would work very well for the instrumentation of the new, you know, the new person. And ask them if they would like, for much less money, you know, they should still be paid, but it won't be as expensive, to have an adaptation created for them. And that's a win-win for everybody, because you get the piece performed, you get a new version of it, and those people get a new piece from you. So it's very helpful. It's very good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Alex, we've been on the phone a long time. So.
I know. It's ridiculous. thank you so much for your patience.
No, thank you for joining me. This has been great.
Well, you have wonderful questions, and your curiosity and, you know, your friendship as a peer is wonderful. You are a friend to many, many people. And
well, I try.
I want to thank you.
Well, I'm working on it. That's certainly one of my goals, is to connect people and to connect myself. You know, part of the podcast is that I want to talk to people. I want to be able to call and speak with Alex Shapiro, yeah, or Jerry Junkin, or whoever it is I'm speaking to.
Yeah,
I mean, it matters to me, too, to hear what people have to say.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, and continue on with this great series. It's really worthwhile. It's a wonderful series, Mark.
Alex, thank you so much.